Bonjour, I'm Lisa. Though I live in Toronto a lot, my home is in Port Severn, where there's rocks and moss and trees and even eagles nesting over the water. I live there with my partner and my dog, and I'm a language learner and an artist too. Over to you, Tanya.
Thanks, Lisa. I'm Tanya. I'm an activator of Bush Gallery, a land-based gallery for experimental land and Indigenous-centered practices. It's spring, and I'm looking out at the yellow hills filled with balsam root sunflowers, which is my son's namesake in our language.
Oh my gosh, those hills, those yellow flowers. I remember hiking up there with you and like just laying on the ground and looking at all the flowers in the sky. It was so beautiful. I love that place.
I'm glad you remember that. That was a great visit.
You are listening to Sounds Like Land, a podcast where we journey from the West Coast to the East Coast of Indigenous territories.
This is the third episode of our podcast series, Sounds Like Land, and we've invited regional hosts and guests to be in conversation about their lands and languages. This episode is hosted by Laura Greer, who's here with us now, and it's called the Rad Alberta episode.
Yeah, hi, I'm Laura. In this episode, I talk with Nigel Robinson, Auntie Tiffany Janvière, Becca Taylor, and Christina Battle on building resilience and sharing intergenerational knowledge through medicine, ceremony, and gardens. And it's called the Rad Alberta episode because at one point when we were talking with one of the guests, both Nigel and I said, "That's rad."
Okay, I really got into this episode, Laura. I love listening to it. You know, you go from a swamp walk in Cold Lake First Nations to an artist-led garden in a place we now know as Edmonton. So you really go from the bush to the city. I want our listeners to enjoy as we broadcast the seeds of Indigenous languages.
Into Sounds Like Land.
This is a podcast where we're broadcasting seeds of Indigenous languages.
Walking through the fields of yellow, I stumbled upon one lonely flower. The petals were facing the sun. She grew up so tall. Nothing could make that thing fall. The sun came along and said, "I want that one in my bed," and took her home.
What do you got here?
This is bark. And it's a really nice sample of it too. This bark is used as a medicine, and then it's also used for the powder is kind of can be used as a you cover your skin with it, and I think it can be used as like a very eco-friendly bug spray, and then I think the powder is also just good for your skin.
That's Nigel. Nigel is a Dene Cold Lake First Nation activist, comedian, and podcaster. And I'm walking around with him and his cousin in the bush at Berry Point, just outside of Cold Lake, Alberta. We're surrounded by trees and the familiar sounds and smells of the woods, and we're here to pick some berries. What's your favorite thing about the Saskatoon berries? Like, what do you like? Do you like to make things with them?
Yeah, pies. I like Saskatoon berry pies. And I like taking a bunch of Saskatoons, making sure they're all clean, like a whole handful, and then just eating them all at once. That is the best way to eat them. And I find Saskatoons are really tied deeply to memory for me. Like, my grandma had a lot of Saskatoons, and she picked a lot, and she made a lot of pies. And so, for me, Saskatoons are very intrinsically tied to memories of my grandma. And, one of the ways people really like to eat both Saskatoons and blueberries around Cold Lake is they like to boil water and then cover the berries in the boiled water and then empty it. This is if they're frozen, so that they get nice and thawed out. And then put a little bit of cream in with them, mix it up, and then just eat it like that. And maybe add a little bit of sugar. And it is delicious. So I'd suggest that.
Hi, I'm Laura Greer, and this is the Rad Alberta episode of the Sounds Like Land podcast. In the summer of 2023, I traveled back to the place that I grew up in, a place I often dream in that's full of memories of rolling hills and boreal forests. I grew up in a pulp mill town called Hinton, but I am Satu Dene from the north, and I never had the chance to grow up with my own nation's teachings, so I often look towards my local communities to connect with. I think about my time in Alberta a lot, and I always find myself back here. And I find myself coming back again to make an episode for this podcast. And the first person I thought of working with on this was with Nigel, who I met a long time ago when I was working with grassroots organizations in Edmonton. He's not only a cool Dene, but he has so much experience working as a radio host for CJSR and does a lot of Indigenous rights advocacy. And he was also someone who took me to my very first powwow. Nigel offered to come with me on this journey to chat with others who call this land their home and find out about how others find community here. We find ourselves in the place now called Edmonton, which is an important place for me as my family still lives here, but also because it marks the beginning phase of my artistic career.
Okay, you're going to really test my knowledge here. Okay, so these, we have some Black Eye Susans in here. So these ones are, I don't know, they really remind me of sunflowers because they have those, the yellow petals with the kind of like black center that kind of comes out a little bit into like a dome-like shape. But the leaves are different than sunflowers, and it's usually more stalks coming up, whereas sunflowers are usually singular. These ones come up in groups.
That's Becca, talking about the plants that grow in Otsitsiwan's community garden. I first met Becca a few years back, just before I moved to Toronto, and she's an amazing artist and curator and former executive director of Otsitsiwan Contemporary Art Collective. Otsitsiwan is an Indigenous artist organization that had just opened up their own gallery and space in 2020, and it's located in Edmonton's Chinatown. And it was my first time being there when I went to visit Becca.
Let's see. So these are tobacco leaves here. So you can see they're going to get those leaves are going to get really quite big, and it's going to get higher. And then as it kind of like wilts, you can actually collect the bottom of them as they wilt, and you could dry them out and use that. Sweetgrass, which, comes up in... each one has four. One side's like shiny, one side's a little bit more dull and lighter in color. And these ones aren't quite ready yet. They'll start smelling like really quite sweet when they're like ready to harvest. So we have a bunch of that throughout the garden too, that hopefully folks will harvest when they're ready. And then we have... here's some yarrow, which is, the flowers aren't looking that nice right now, but usually has like these like clutters of like white little flowers, and the leaves are very fern-like, smaller little leaves that kind of come out from the base of it. And what else do we have?
They have parsnips going to seed this year, kind of by accident, even though I've been really trying, because they are plants that are biennial. So they, you know, you eat them in the 1 year, you eat the root, and then the second year is when they go to seed. And I had two that just stuck around the roots. I didn't pick them last year. And this year they're finally going to seed. And it's amazing to watch and learn from.
And that's Christina. Christina is a media artist based in Edmonton and has done extensive research and work around plant systems, community, and disasters. This is my first time meeting Christina, but when I used to work in Edmonton, I remember hearing about her so much, and I knew that there was someone I always wanted to have the chance to meet and talk with. So I invited both Becca and Christina to sit with me and Nigel to talk more about living on this land and to dive a little deeper into what they think about community, land, gardens, and art.
I work with practices that take time. So a lot of that has to do with working with like video and time-based work. But I also work a lot with seeds and plants and gardening. And that really informs a lot of my thinking through, especially as it relates to time. So thinking a lot about seasonal changes, how long it takes for things to grow. And that really informs how I define media artist in general as well. And I grew up here in Edmonton. I'd been away for quite a long time, like a couple decades. But I've been back now, I think like 5 or 6 years, maybe 5. And super grateful and happy to be back. And I feel like being back has also kind of actually really helped me articulate like the things that are important to me as an artist and in my practice, and plants being at the center of that for sure.
The space we did originally introduce to the area in 2021, I believe, and it was in partnership actually with Finding Flowers. We had just opened up the gallery, and a really close friend of ours owned this vacant lot and asked if we would be interested in doing something within this vacant lot. And we immediately thought of this garden space. And then this year, we just really wanted to focus on having Alberta native plant species. So we did a lot of research and worked with TD this year, Friends of the Environment. So we worked with some of the folks there that have a lot of knowledge on Alberta specific plants. We have sweetgrass this year, lots of tobacco this year. You know, we do encourage people when it's ready to like harvest it. We harvested the tobacco we planted last year, so we can use that to gift and use as protocol as well.
Sitting in this garden with them, surrounded by the sounds of the city, I wanted to know what they thought about living in urban spaces.
So I have always lived in urban spaces. I don't really know anything else. And I always have gardened within urban spaces as well. So I do really feel like having an urban garden is quite different than maybe what even a suburban garden is, or certainly like even more rural as well. And I think, like, you hear a lot about community gardens, and I, as far as I know, at least, or in my experience, they're very much like a solution to this problem of not necessarily having space when you live in urban centers. And I feel like they're super important, community gardens, but I feel like I've had like a lot of negative experiences with them, partly because of how maybe they think about the word community and what that means. So like for me, I think a lot about community as something that is more activated, maybe like ideals that are more aligned, ethics that are aligned. And that really goes hand in hand with thinking about plants and gardening for me, like why it is that we garden or what benefits come from it. But I don't know that necessarily everyone who gardens thinks about that or cares about that. And so I feel like one of the things about gardening in urban spaces, when you sort of are, I don't know, forced is maybe a harsh way to think about it, but forced to be a part of a community garden network, is trying to find those alignments of interest and understanding, right? And in my experience, that's one thing that's really hard to find in a community garden. Like, it's really great to have access to space in the urban environment, but maybe space isn't enough, really, right? Or maybe a group of folks who aren't necessarily all gardening for the same reason just isn't what I'm personally looking for. So I feel like I think about that when it comes to urban spaces. I think one of the interesting things about maybe this city is I feel like there are a lot of people who are really engaged in thinking about plants and gardening, you know, for various reasons, but for reasons that I feel like are really aligned with one another, certainly with myself. So maybe there's like something unique about that in this particular city.
I also grew up in urban spaces primarily. I did spend like a lot of time out in the bush with, I think my dad's a hunter, and we spent a lot of time foraging, berry picking, and for like medicines, and all the ceremony I participated in when I was a kid was out in the bush as well. So we just spent like a lot of time out of the city. And I guess the older I got, the more I was wanting to see it like in urban centers, you know, because I think a lot about accessibility, and it took me a really long time to get my driver's license, you know, so it was hard for me as like a young adult to continue accessing those things, living in urban spaces, and kind of like as I was like moving around and traveling and kind of really desperate to kind of hold on to, you know, as Kevin starting to navigate this adult life I found myself in. And yeah, so it's just this like this need. And I think gardens was like the first place I kind of went to. And, you know, my mother had a garden growing up, like a very large one. I was very privileged to like live in a house where there's a lot of yard space for her to, and that's like primarily how we were fed, was through her garden, and did a lot of canning in that. So I think that's where I was like naturally gravitated to, but I kind of found the same thing in community gardens. I think I was like looking a lot more for that like family and community connection. For me, gardens are connected to family and the way we gather. And I guess also like meals, like sharing meals and everything too. So when I think about these spaces now, you know, and I think about this space too, I like this garden that we're sitting in, you know, I think about it beyond just what we're offering or how we're planting, but how we're also gathering and utilizing this space. And I think everybody needs garden spaces for different reasons, but I think they can also exist in a very different way to kind of meet those needs. And like I was kind of saying before, and I think that really shifts and changes depending on who's accessing those spaces.
I then wanted to ask them to tell me more about their ideas around accessing community.
To gate or not to gate, like a public urban garden, I feel like a lot of the time community gardens, because they're so formalized, and maybe this is just nature of their design, like maybe certainly there's like a reason for why they are organized in the way that they are, because it's hard to bring different groups of people together to like do a thing. But I feel like something about the negotiation of how rules are determined feels really important to me, to be open and adaptable in a garden space. Thinking about family and meals and sharing, like all of that I really hold dearly within the realm of the garden as well. Maybe a lot of this like kind of comes down to trying to figure out like modes for community building through gardens. And because they're often so formalized, community gardens maybe don't always necessarily have that as a goal. But I'm really similar in that every city that I've lived in, that's the first thing I've kind of sought out to try to like find people that, you know, going to a place where you don't know anyone, it's like, okay, I'll join a community garden network, I'll find friends and family. And it's just, yeah, not necessarily gone super well, which is maybe my own naivety, but like rules I really struggle with. And gardening can come with a lot of like bureaucratic colonial ways of thinking about plants and land that are hard to like work against when you're in those networks. Like, because we're sitting in the garden, it's very open to, like, there's so many angles of sight and imagining like how welcoming that is for someone who especially like doesn't quite know like what they're getting into when they open the doors of a gallery, here, like, everything's laid bare. Like, you know what you're getting into. In fact, you don't even have to come into the garden to be able to participate, which is really lovely.
I guess where we're located too is a really transitional community is around here, and there's a lot of folks that move in and out of this neighborhood, and we need to take that into consideration as we kind of program this space and think about what we're putting in this space. Something that we keep in the space that has been like really important for us is that water cistern, which obviously is like to water the plants, but we actually chose, because we were encouraged to lock it up at the beginning, and we chose not to because we're just like, no, everybody should have access to some water. To water the plants or use it whatever they need. We have a lot of folks that utilize it for many different things. So we're happy to keep that full for whatever use it may need. But yeah, I think different communities come in and different folks activate it in different ways and need to use it for different ways. And we're not really here to dictate what that looks like, but because it's open to everybody. But you know, I think what I'm really loving the most is working in this neighborhood. And meeting so many different communities and hearing their stories and relationships to plants, you know, because we're very close to Chinatown and we have like a relationship with a lot of the Chinese community here. And they've told me some phenomenal stories about like goji berries in this area and like how they've like, there's a friend, an artist that has done like a work on it about why goji berries exist where they exist in Edmonton at, I love hearing those stories, and I love like I love people popping in and sharing their knowledge about plants and what they've learned or done or what they grew up with. I just find it so fascinating. I just love it, and I just love hearing like the conversations that happen within this space. I learned so much from those folks, and I just feel very privileged to be able to engage with them and listen.
Finally, I asked them to talk a little bit about how art and creativity plays a role in their communities.
Thinking about gardens artistically comes from that sort of, I guess, like my failed experiences of working with community gardens. So really trying to find community through gardening, but that's much more distributed. So a lot of the work that I do and think about really tries to build like networks of folks who are interested in things and who are gardening in their own locales that aren't necessarily in the same geographies that I am, and trying to make connections with them across distance. And I really do like, I really do think that a lot of that comes from like trying to seek that out in the community garden structure and not quite finding it. So for me, I think a lot of this also comes down to just like relationship building and, you know, finding folks who are interested in gardening and growing plants and thinking about plants, but also really encouraging those who maybe like are interested but have no idea or have no space, and trying to help share knowledge about how like you could still do it, right? So a lot of the work I do is really invested in like sharing seeds and also trying to give a lot of information of how to work with those seeds. And, you know, if you have a fire escape or you have a ledge with some sun in the kitchen or something, how you could still have a garden in your own terms, and trying to encourage that. And I think like trying to do that in ways, which maybe I sometimes fail at, but that's much more long term. So like repeated conversations with folks and sharing like seeds and stories about gardening season after season, because the nice thing that is a reality about especially gardening outside is that there's a hibernation period where everything's dormant, where you can kind of reflect on things and then it brings back up again. So I really appreciate that those like ongoing conversations that happen over years of gardening together, learning about what folks are struggling with growing plants in other locations, or what's like really thriving, and paying attention to how those gardens and strategies change over the years as well.
As I kind of think about these like larger things
you know, and how I exist in space, or how I want to like curate space or build my relationships and educate myself and learn certain things. You know, I think there's going to be, you can't be perfect within all of it. And I think, you know, there's so much value in learning as you're going, you know, so sometimes you gotta just go do it and not beat yourself up if it fails. Recently being a director of a gallery and or an art center, and it's actually a lesson that has been really taught to me through this garden space. It's really making me like critically think about what it means to have an art center, at least four white walls. You know, I do think it's like still really important that we have a lot of representation within these spaces, but something I really learned from this space is that not everybody feels comfortable in those settings, and it actually still discourages, no matter how much you work to include like marginalized voices within it, or like critically look at your structures. Like, there's something about that physical white walls that can be a huge barrier for a lot of people to come into their programs and access what the works that you're doing. Right? And to this day, I would say our garden programs have the most activity and most participants within them. I think there's something really comfortable about being outside, and for a lot of folks who don't feel comfortable within those spaces, you know, so that's like something that we just noticed and just started like really going with as well. And you know, I mean we're not the only space that's working in outdoor spaces. There's like a lot of spaces across Canada and a lot of art done by really incredible artists activating these outdoor spaces in different ways, I think are really, really profound, because I don't think art needs to only exist within these white walls. I think you know, we're surrounded by these beautiful spaces that can accommodate really a beautiful work and really beautiful ideas and programming within it. You know, and as I kind of think critically about artist-run center structure, gallery structures, you know, like, how do we kind of resist kind of these really capitalist modes in production? Because do we actually need a physical space in order to do this work? Or can we be more collective run or more community run without these spaces, and do it more with what around the environment that already exists around us?
It was really nice to be able to talk with Becca and Christina and learn about what they thought about being here. Before we ended our visiting session, I wanted to have Christina to leave us with some of her final thoughts.
Thinking in other ways, decolonization, resistance, climate change, like all these massive, massive things. And like trying to find ways to have conversations that talk about the thing, but then also like have strategies or solutions for like, I don't know, like next steps or how to put those things into action. Even if action isn't the thing that people have capacity for, like how to feel comfortable with that. And I have no answers for this, but I just feel like I've definitely noticed an increase in that, like, yeah, just kind of like doom about stuff. And it stuck with me because I don't feel like I sit with that feeling myself. So I've been trying to think about like why, like what is it that I can hold on to that's like gets me out of that kind of like doominess and into something else. I feel like plants are at the center of that for me. And so I don't know.
At that point, we parted ways with Christina, but we stuck around to wander around the garden. And since Becca was still working, we wanted to ask her about the names of the plants.
Do you know any of the, perhaps, indigenous language names of any of these?
No, I do not. I mean, that's like an ongoing relationship too, like language learning and the plants, and yeah, it's a process. I don't, like I said, I'm not like a speaker. I know a few words here and there, but we actually work a lot with language speakers. Like Emily Riddle helped us with the translation for this garden.
quite a bit. So we do kind of like really rely on fluent speakers to help us out. And I just haven't quite picked it up nicely yet. So no, I don't know any of the names. So my family's Cree, but we come from like more northern Manitoba. So we speak the N dialect out there. You know, and I'm not like a fluent language speaker, you know, so I'm learning kind of as I can learn and work with language speakers.
Rad.
Totally rad.
Cool, thank you.
I can really relate with Becca. Language is a long journey, and we may never be able to speak our language fluently, but it's still important to hold on to what you can. As I learn my own Dene language, I find that when I come to know each word, it feels like a small part of me has been put back together. On a side note, the word in my language for Edmonton is Mulanene, which roughly translates to white person land. My uncle once told me that he thought the reason why we named white people Mula, which translates to round hand, is because that when white people came, they wore rings on their fingers. So, round, thing, and hand. I asked Nigel what he thought about language.
Language is really the bedrock of culture, and language can kind of be the thing that folds together all of those other things. Because language is a watershed of culture, and it kind of carries the worldview and the intentions and the way in which that a people interacts with the world all within it.
I wanted to pause here for a moment to talk about how I met Nigel. And kind of like how Christina meets people through community gardens, I tended to try to connect with people by working with grassroots organizations. While I was volunteering for places like Greenpeace in Edmonton, I met Nigel while attending some sort of retreat that they were having. And it was during that gathering that a bunch of us took a drive out to a powwow. I remember that night really well because it was my first time ever being to one. And Nigel was kind enough to explain all the details about the dances and procedures. I absolutely loved watching the dancing, and the loud drumming really connected with me. Now, whenever I get the chance, I try to make it to a powwow that Nigel is drumming in. Oh, and Nigel drums and sings too. I'll make sure to share some of that a bit later. Anyways, I wanted to ask Nigel to tell me more about his nation.
So Cold Lake First Nations is right between Saskatchewan and Alberta. It's around the middle point of what you would see on the map. And the lake itself is super deep. And it's really notable because it's 5 kilometers deep about. And it's said that it was created by a meteor thousands upon thousands of years ago. And there's a story that a giant died and it fell around the Great Bear Lakes, and then its head landed around Cold Lake. And that's why there's so many medicines in that area, like rat root and sage and sweetgrass, and so many berries, blueberries, raspberries, saskatoons, bunchberries, all kinds of berries.
We were talking in the middle of the street of Edmonton, and this made me want to know more about what he thought about living in this place.
Edmonton is a really cool place. North side of the river, it was known as kind of Dene territory historically, and then south side of the river was known as Blackfoot territory. And I think the things that really make me feel home about here is that it's probably the river valley. There's so many medicines and berries and things growing down there. For some reason, there's a law that foraging is illegal around here, but, you know, it's not really a thing that's enforced. But yeah, you could really get out into nature down there in a way that you can't in most cities. I've lived in Toronto and Vancouver as well in my adult life. And those cities, it's not as easy to kind of like take a walk into the River Valley or take a bus over to the River Valley and kind of be surrounded by nature and trees. Yeah, it's a very special city in that it has like all of this green space that you could just go exploring around in and go off and pick some Saskatoons or just enjoy the sounds and sights of nature. You know, there's some parts of it that you don't even feel like you're in a city. The tough thing about cities is it's kind of like, for me, there's been so much encouragement and demand to create all cities to look the same and to have malls and to have strip malls and to have all the same stores and businesses. So like all of those features of the city just like don't really interest me that much, but the River Valley does. And like the things of nature of places interest me, and like the unique things, not really like the, you know, the chain businesses, the malls, all that stuff. So yeah, I think that the River Valley is really what makes the city special. It makes me feel kind of connected back home to Cold Lake.
I then wanted Nigel to talk to me more about his family and their relationship to art, because one of Nigel's uncles is none other than Alex Janvier, who sadly passed away about a year after this episode was recorded.
And for those of you who don't know, Alex Janvier was a part of the Indian Group of Seven. Well, it still is. And that group was known to take native art and artists from kind of being considered a roadside attraction to being considered fine contemporary art. And if you have never seen any of his art, just Google his name, Alex Janvier, and you'll see a whole bunch of different pieces. And yeah, his art takes a lot of inspiration from the land and the water and all the medicines and the animals around Cold Lake. And you could see so much in a single piece. It's all very abstract, but it, you know, there's so much to it. And the colors kind of flow in different ways. And the line work is kind of what it's really notable for. And yeah, he thinks in a very interesting way. And he shared with me in the past that while he was in residential school, you know, that art class that he was a part of really helped him get through. And I thought that was really special. And him and Papa John, they went to that school together, and they both managed to go on and live these pretty incredible lives. So yeah, they're very special to me. And yeah, Cold Lake is very special. My auntie be a part of the conversation because she practices a spiritual way of life, and her family ties are to her dad, John Janvier. And John Janvier is a person who was a huge advocate for our language for the whole latter half of his life. He taught at our Legoff school for 20 or 30 years, and he helped develop the Dene program at Blue Quills University. And beyond that, he helped develop apps and developed Roman orthography, which is kind of like Dene syllabics. And he just was really dedicated, and he really worked hard to share the knowledge that he had with the people in his life. And that knowledge and that kind of joy in learning and teaching Indigenous culture really lives on in Aunt Tiffany.
When I was first talking about this episode to Nigel, he suggested that I should talk to his Aunt Tiffany, and he invited me to go up and visit them. It was an honor to be brought into their home and space, so I was more than happy to make the trip up there. But first, I had to make a Costco trip so I could bring them some things that included a big bag of pancake mix. I then borrowed my parents' car and took a nice couple-hour drive up to Cold Lake. When I arrived to his aunt's house, I was greeted by some really cute dogs and met some of his cousins. I set up a little tent in their yard and joined them in their kitchen to play some board games. By the end of the night, they had set up some fireworks and we all went to bed. In the morning, Tiffany was still sleeping, so we made some breakfast. I learned that burnt pancakes was the norm in this house, so I felt like I could at least give them some burnt-free pancakes for letting me stay there. When Tiffany got up and finished her first cup of coffee, we sat down on her porch that overlooked her yard and started to chat. I wanted to know more about her, and I wanted to ask her about how she came to know the things that she knows.
So, my name is Tiffany Janvier. My spirit name is Sa'ani Nagida Tsekui, which means, like, you know, when the... I don't even know how to explain it, but it's like when the sun's first coming up, woman who's sitting with the sun, that like the rising sun kind of thing. But my dad told me, like before he passed away, he told me that it, he said it differently. So I don't know. It, there's different versions of Dene, I guess. And so it depends on where you're, which region you're from, right? Other than that, I am from the area traditionally known as Tloechoktue, where I grew up. I grew up on a farm, and in the area known as Good Cow Lake. That's just the traditional name for those little lakes that, you know, in the area that the old people know about. And I thought there was some kind of, our people wanted to revise these names and put them back to our traditional names. I don't know where that is in the process, and I sure hope that that goes through. I currently work for our nation in post-secondary education. I also like to do massages and acupuncture on the side, and where I can, I like to just go picking plants, medicines, when I can. So... yeah, that's basically what I do. Well, growing up, the person that actually was teaching me was my dad. I was raised by my dad at an early age, since I was 3 years old, and he had a farm. So we did a lot of walking on the land, and that's basically where I learned a lot of, like, that's where my first teachings came from, was my dad. And at the time, it didn't seem like it was just like, it was kind of natural, like we'd just be walking along and he'd point out a plant and he'd tell me what it was and he'd tell me how, what it was used for. And, but he didn't know how to prepare them, but he had that knowledge, right? I was very young. I don't know how old I was. And my dad was pointing out this plant. It was yarrow. And the reason why it stuck with me is because I liked that word, yarrow. It sounded so cool, right? So I was like, yarrow. And I kept repeating it in my head, yarrow, yarrow. And then he was telling me about how when we, if there's somebody that has skin problems, that you can boil it and bath in it, the yarrow, or you can put it on, like you can just chew it up and put it on your skin. Like, say if you have a scab or something, you can chew it in your mouth and then put it on. Because the other thing that my dad taught me was our saliva is sacred. And so when we use our saliva and the intention of how we think about it or pray about it is what helps as well. So, and that goes back to the old teachings. I'm sure that a lot of our young people were told, don't spit on anybody. Don't spit on the ground. Don't spit here. Don't spit there, right? Don't ever curse and spit on somebody because that's medicine, right? Our own selves are medicine. Our own saliva is sacred. So, and I learned that from my dad is like a long time ago as a young child. Walking through these fields, like I did not realize how much my dad was actually teaching me. I had no idea. You know, until I grew older and I started thinking, well, how do I know this? And something would click in. Oh, yeah, I remember we were walking and he was just talking to us, you know. So that was one of my earliest memories of first learning about a medicine. And it simply is just putting tobacco down and chewing on it and putting your intention into that healing, wherever it needs, whatever it needs to be for, right? I think later on, I came across I don't know what I kind of wanted to learn these ways right on my own. So I started seeking out knowledge in different places with different people. And sure, they had a lot of good knowledge, but sometimes I just felt like it wasn't true. So I just, for myself, I'd either just discard the teaching or I would use it, right? And usually I used it first myself, and then I would use it. I would try and like use it for myself, and I'd see how I felt about it. And if it didn't feel good, then I just try something different. Yeah. And then later on, I found a very beautiful Sundance family, and whom I really, really completely connected with on all levels, really. And we share a lot of the same similar mindsets on different subjects. And a lot of their knowledge of teaching me about different medicines, herbs, setting up ceremonies, how they conduct themselves within the circle, all these kind of things, that's really inspiring to me. And that's where I'm getting a lot of my teachings from now. Also, one of the biggest and best teachings is self, right? Your own self spirit. Like when either you go through a dream or this knowledge just comes to you naturally. Like, for example, I think my first experience learning from the spirit world, I guess, or something, some guiding force, I dreamt of how to, like what this wild rose petals were meant for. And in that dream, they showed me this wild rose, and then it was almost like in the dream, I knew what it was used for as I picked it and looked at it. Didn't know how to heart or didn't know how to fix it for what reason, but you know, that came later on, right? And then later on, it was about a couple weeks later, I was walking and I seen these wild rose petals, and then I remembered, oh my God, my dream. So then I went and I put some tobacco down and I started picking them. And I didn't pick a whole lot. But, you know, basically what I was shown was to make tea with it. And it's more like a woman's tea for their skin, for their hair, you know, to maintain the mostly for hair, really. Healthy hair, healthy skin. So that was one of my first teachings. So it's on by myself, right, or on my own.
At this point, I wanted to know a bit more about her knowledge around plants and language.
Oh wait, some of the things I'd like to like, maybe some of the Dene words that to help. I just wrote some down, just so that I could just kind of share like some of the, one of the important things in medicine picking is like roots, right? There are all kinds of roots. So, I mean, you pick all rat root or, you know, I can't really say the bulbs of plants, you know, like, for example, like tiger lilies. We use tiger lilies for eye medicine. So I don't know how to say that in Dene, but the word roots, eche gaye, that's how we would say it. Eche gaye could be different in Satu region, right? Or more northern Dene as well, or, you know, Hudson Bay Dene. It all depends. The other thing that we use a lot of is bark, all different kinds of bark trees, right? And how I would say that is de la tuzi. Yeah. Another thing that we use is sap. A lot of different kind of saps from trees, right? And these are just basic words, right? It's es tue. That's how I would say es tue. It's like sap, right? Anything like in our language, anything that has a property of water or runny or something, there's always tue attached to it and with another connecting word. I guess just dreaming of some of these things at an early age were my first inspiration, right? Because once this came to me, I was like, I'm glad that I was not as broken enough to be able to just do these things physically, right? Like for example, dreaming of the wildflower, the wild rose, right? Like that was meaning for. So I had enough knowledge to be able to go pick it. And when I picked it, I just stood there because I didn't know how to harvest it. I was thinking, well, how to fix it, or what am I do, right? And I thought, sat there for a while, and I thought, oh, I'll make a tea with this. And then I thought, well, how do I make tea? I'll boil water and stick it in there, right? So a lot of these things were just kind of like self-thought and self-taught, I guess. Those simple things. So that was one of my first inspirations, right? I'm starting to learn about medicines and stuff. And so I got excited and I couldn't wait till the next teaching. And the other thing that really inspires me is knowing that I'm going to be a grandmother someday, and that I want to be able to teach my young grandkids this knowledge, the knowledge that was not passed to us the way it was or it should have been, right? So I want to be there, and I want to be able to go for walks and show them all these little things and tell them how to pick it and harvest it. So that's an inspiration. And not only for myself, like I got a lot of kids that come through here visiting, or people as well. So I go out. I want to learn to be able to teach them, and they all have teachings themselves. There's a hummingbird right there. Look, it's right there. Oh, it flew away. Yeah. My other inspiration is just being raised in ceremonies like sweats, and also now I got into Sundance family. So to me, that's inspiration in itself. Like, you know, just being out there with them, and they share and pass a lot of knowledge on through the ceremony. Not only that, when we're also just sitting there and, you know, we're just connecting and having, you know, that connection, it's, you know, we all learn from each other, right? And it's a beautiful feeling, like just to be able to sit there and sit with people with the same like mind, you know, that can actually teach you something. And then that relationship becomes, it's not all about taking, it's a give and take relationship. And that's the balance that we're all missing, I think, in our lives, right?
I could really tell how much she loved and cared about her community and passing on these teachings to her family. I wanted to know more about what inspires her and inspires her to keep moving forward.
To me, that's an inspiration. Every time that I come together, it's always looking forward to. And then for weeks, you got this pep and you keep, it's always on my mind, right? And I think, okay, well, maybe I could do this. Maybe we could do that, you know? So we're going to have a medicine picking camp here in the next 2 weeks here at my house, or just whoever wants to come and just gather, mostly from the ceremony, the Sundance family or whoever. I mean, it's open. And basically what we're going to do is just mostly be visiting, drinking tea. Yeah, we'll go out and pick medicines like sage, sweetgrass, rat root, and go look for whatever else they may be looking for, right? I mean, I don't know where everything is, but we'll do it together. Basically is what it comes down to. And I think that in itself is good medicine. And when you pick that good medicine with that good intention already, and it's surrounded you, makes it stronger, right?
As we come close to the end of our conversation, I wanted to share some of her thoughts about the different ways we learn.
So teachings come in many different forms, many different ways. And I think it's very important for people to acknowledge all these different ways of learning. It doesn't only come from one person. It doesn't come from person. It comes from yourself as well, from the creator, from your guiding grandfathers and grandmothers. You know, and I think that one of the things that I'd like to acknowledge is that I think, because in the spirit world, our great grandfathers and grandmothers, they're still teaching us. They're still there for us, right? And they know that what our parents and what our grandparents went through, you know, that big rip in society, in our society, in our way of who we are, right? All their parenting skills as well. Like, they didn't have that. So I think on the other side, our great grandfathers and grandmothers are reaching out to us so that knowledge is not lost. to myself, I always believe that no matter what knowledge that we have, even if the last person on earth knew about it and they passed away without teaching, I always think it'll always come back. I always feel like it'll always come back no matter what, whether it be one or two generations or three, who knows, but it'll always come back.
I think about that conversation a lot. I thought about the ways our knowledges find its way back to us. And I thought about everything that I've heard up until now and what it is that this podcast can do. I asked Nigel what he thought.
It's so integral for this podcast. Like, it's so wonderful that this podcast is focused on nature and focused on like utilizing art and language and education to kind of bring people, to draw people back into nature. That's something that education has worked so hard to do, to take us away from for a long time, to put us into very specific jobs. But there's so much more to being alive than just like having a 9-to-5 job, or, and to really honor ourselves and honor the places that we come from, we need to be in these places and doing these things.
These voices are but a breath of what all could be said about this land now called Alberta. I wish we could have talked to even more people and visited more places, but maybe that just means I'll have to come back at some point and do another episode. At one point, while I was walking around the woods with Nigel and his cousin, I thought about all of these things that we have talked about, which are really just the various ways we connect, such as within community, with land, in our languages, and our expressions through creativity and care. And I felt comfort in knowing that people like Nigel, Christina, Becca, and Tiffany are keeping these values of community going, and that the place that I grew up will always have these people in them, making me feel okay with leaving again. Mosquitoes suck.
They're still getting
it? Yeah. It's just preparing me for when I go back up, when I go up north.
Mm-hmm.
Just getting ready to be eaten alive.
And it's going to be a lot worse.
Yes, very much so.
Example of a really rich blueberry bush.
Mm.
It's got at least 20 berries on it.
What you doing?
Hanging around.
That's Nigel's cousin Silas, by the way. He kept us company while we went around Cold Lake. You used to pick medicine, or berries?
Not berries, but sometimes I'd go sage picking. Yeah. That's about it. I think I've only done it once or twice. I can't remember a lot about it, but yeah. That's about it.
Who would take you?
My mom and my dad, they would. We would normally pick around the Brandon area in Manitoba. That's where a lot of the good sage is, so. Yeah. It's just on the side of the highway. Yeah.
I've been looking around for mint. I can't really see much, but you could usually smell it before you could see it. And the plant itself, it can blend in pretty easily with most of the weeds and other plants surrounding it. But it's the smell that will really give it away. And I don't think it grows in this area. It might just grow deeper in the swamp. But there might be some here. It's definitely possible because there's so much water around.
The smell of the smoke kind of is taking up all of the smell.
Yeah.
Interestingly enough, I recorded this podcast in the summer of 2023, where afterwards I left to go to my own nation in Dalarna in the Northwest Territories, where I found myself stuck in the middle of Yellowknife's first ever full evacuation due to the forest fires. But that story will have to wait for another time. This is Sounds Like Land, and I'm Laura. Masicho, and take care.
Thanks for tuning in. Remember, we want you to have what you need for telling your stories. Learn a word, listen, meet language speakers and learners in your community. Give your language a try. Don't worry if it doesn't sound right at first. You can do it. If you are a language speaker or teacher in your community and want to share your resources, contact us at soundslikeland.ca.
This episode's regional host was Laura Greer, and our guests were Becca Taylor, Christina Battle, and Tiffany Janvier.
Music in this episode includes Nature Song for the Time Being by Fontaine, Reprise of the Sun, Gone and Place to the Land by Laura Ortman, and As If by Laura Pitkinen and Lisa Myers. Nature Sounds recorded by Laura Pitkinen.
Co-producers on this show are Lisa Myers and Nigel Robinson. Project coordinator is Dana Prieto. Researcher and production assistant is Laura Greer. Engineering is Mark Marilainen.
This podcast was created with the support of the Canada Council for the Arts, the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council, the Digital Justice Fund, and York University.